over to Roots immediately and that he can start taking us through the presentation. We will do the presentation and then I will allow members questions of clarity or questions that can clarify issues, but also if there are further information that you do require, that we can get that as well. Mr. Roots, over to you. Sorry for the delay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume it's okay if I sit and make my presentation. Members, thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation. If I could start with the first slide, please. Just to establish who I represent by way of background, SST Operational Risk Services is a locally incorporated security company. It has sister operations in Mozambique concerning maritime security, which is why they have an interest in this particular part of the proposed amendments. It also operates out of Cape Town, providing maritime security as well. Nicol Steyn & Associates is a bodyguarding company that provides high-profile bodyguarding services worldwide. It has an Indian national as a shareholder, which is why it has interest in the proposed amendments concerning foreign ownership. And then VentSafe Security Services is a local company incorporated in South Africa, carries on business in Cape Town. It provides security to large events, which Cape Town attracts quite a lot of. If I can move on to the next slide, please. I think that this slide sums up a great deal of the problems, both with the bill and with security industry in general. No one will take issue with the statement that the industry needs to be regulated and it needs to be regulated properly. It is how the regulation takes place that is the problem. There is an us and them attitude between the authority, CERA, and the industry. CERA, in my view, and I have direct and personal experience of this, is dysfunctional. There's a lack of skills, a lack of capacity within CERA, and there's a lack of understanding of law and the Constitution. There is this us and them attitude because, in my view, if you look at Section 6 of the Act, it provides that the Minister appoints the Council in consultation with Cabinet. There is no industry representation in CERA, and that is bad. The industry needs to be able to communicate with CERA, and there is no such communication at present. And I've quoted there from some of the commentaries on the back of the bill, where it says the draft amendment bill was also a product of an open and transparent consultative process. No, it wasn't. There are some constitutional issues that I'm going to raise. The primary one is the effective expropriation of foreign-owned interests in local companies. And as a result of that, there is, as I've indicated, some level of mistrust and antipathy from the industry to the authority and vice versa. It's not all bad, and I think that some credit must be given to the drafters of the bill, because it is clear that the intention is to create a more solid regulatory framework, and that is to be congratulated. There are a number of problem areas within the security industry that to some extent are addressed in the bill itself. One of those areas is to create partnerships between the private security industry and the law enforcement arms of the state. It has been tried in the past. It has not succeeded for a number of reasons. To formalize it by way of legislation is an extremely positive step. And I have indicated in my presentation as well that one of the things that needs to be examined is the giving of greater powers to certain categories of security officers. If I can just digress for a moment as well and say that security officers, if they've completed the regulatory training, are very well trained. There's quite a number of unit standards that they have to go through, particularly with reference, for example, to firearms. And I do not see a difficulty conferring limited powers on security officers to search and seize and make arrests. And if you can give those powers to certain categories of security officers, that will go a long way to positively reducing crime. And if that can be done in conjunction with the South African Police Services, for example, then it could be a recipe for addressing serious and violent crime in South Africa. We have to look at unintended consequences, and I have divided the unintended consequences down into two categories. The one is quite simply excessive powers to be granted to the minister, which I regard as extremely problematic, and I'll be a little bit more detailed about that later. And the second unintended consequence is we must not create a framework that acts as a bar to entry into the industry. The majority of security officers are black, and it is regarded as a career for them that has very good prospects. The salaries are very good. Armed response officers can earn 15,000 rand or more a month. So many people enter the industry as a career, and they start as what is termed a grade E officer, and they complete additional training, and they can eventually become a grade A or a grade B, which is necessary if you want to become part of management. But we have to be very careful that we don't regulate parts of society that don't need to be regulated. And I've indicated, for example, that there are certain parts of the industry that are informal and not yet regulated, and in my view, don't need to be regulated. And I've given the example of the car guarding industry. We all see these people at shopping centres. Many of them are quite organised. They have an employer, so to speak, and they have a structure where they work shifts. And these people render a security service, but in my view, they don't need to be regulated the same way that a formal security officer would need to be. So we have to be careful about making legislation that's too broad and too ill-defined, that it might cover people that don't need to be regulated. And then the long-term effects, what I want to focus on there is the potential disinvestment from South Africa if there is a change to the definition of security service, and if there's a change affecting foreign ownership of security companies. I think I've covered a great deal of this particular slide and what I've said already. I just want to emphasize that for many people in the security industry, and particularly people from disadvantaged backgrounds, the security industry is an entry into an area of industry that is open to many of them. I would also like to add that when it comes to creating regulatory frameworks, and there is a part of the bill that confers upon the minister the power to determine what the requirements are for any particular part of the industry, like armed guarding, cash in transit, we must be very careful that we do not over-regulate, because you do not want to stifle participation in the industry and exclude new startup companies because they can't comply with the regulatory requirements. I have concerns as well that when you say the minister may prescribe and we don't know what the regulations are, I have concerns that those requirements may become law without the necessary scrutiny of the committee or of parliament. So I would always urge that you do not give too many powers of regulation to any minister. My first point on here may be a little bit difficult to understand, but it's a principle of drafting legislation that you should state what you cannot do, not what you can do, because it will create certainty. If you say you cannot ride in a car, then riding a bicycle is permissible. So you need to be precise in what you put into legislation, and the only way that you can do that is to simply say you cannot do that. That creates certainty. I've indicated as well, in an open and democratic society, all law must be scrutinized by Parliament. That's why I have concerns about regulations. We all know that there's been a number of relatively high profile cases where regulations and even legislation have been quite successfully challenged in the High Court and in the Constitutional Court because it hasn't been properly debated and hasn't been properly examined. So I don't like the situation where you give powers to a government official without the scrutiny of Parliament. And I've indicated there that you should discourage broad sweeping unsuspected powers to a minister, and I've indicated it may have a negative impact on business, and the reason for that, for me saying that, is because if the minister passes a regulation saying that the cash and transit industry must be 100% locally owned, then you're going to have certain companies that are partly foreign owned leaving the country. It may be important because I've looked on the program and I see that there's a number of foreign owned companies that do not appear to be participating in these processes, and I just want to tell the committee some of the companies that are foreign owned. G4S, which is heavily involved in the cash and transit industry and the guarding industry, is foreign owned. And I believe it is the second or third largest security company in the country. There is a company called Securitas that's owned in Sweden and is totally foreign owned and operates in Cape Town and in Johannesburg. Mavela Panda ADT indirectly is partly foreign owned because its shares are listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And then there is Chubb Security, which you should all know, which is American owned, totally American owned. And that is the largest armed response provider of services in the country. So we're looking at a situation, if you do exclude foreign ownership or if you limit foreign ownership, there may be a reversal of capital out of the country and a disinvestment. I then do focus on some of the positive aspects of the bill, the creation of potential partnerships, which I regard as very positive. Crime prevention partnerships, I think the industry is very happy with. The reality is that on the ground, most security companies, most established and properly functioning security companies, work on a day-to-day basis with SAPs anyway, and quite effectively. This just gives formalization to that cooperation, which is very positive. I then indicated that certain security officers need additional powers, such as the power of arrest, search and seizure. That would need to be regulated in the Act. And then we're getting on to some of the more contentious areas. I now speak about the rationale and purpose of the Act, and this is the most problematic part of the Act as far as I and my clients are concerned and the industry as a whole. The explanation in the notes to the bill say that there's a foreign threat to the security of South Africa. That is absolute rubbish. And until I see evidence of that, I will not accept it, and I would urge this committee not to accept it. You can't make a broad sweeping statement to the effect that because of the security threat to the Republic of South Africa, we must remove foreign ownership from local security companies. That's unfounded and unjustified, and if there's anybody here from the ministry, I'd like them to explain to me how they come to that conclusion. And I'd like to see the evidence, and I'd like that evidence tested. And I would urge this committee very strongly that SAPs come here and that they explain what this threat is and that it be quantifiable, please. I can also say, without hesitation, that if there is any limitation of foreign ownership on local security companies, it will go to court. I already have instructions to challenge it. I do raise the issue of some of the too broad, too undefined definitions that are proposed. And I'm going to be a little bit specific for a moment. The definition of a security service is now intended to include distributing or transporting security equipment. That would mean that all couriers, as well as state bodies such as Transnet that would be involved in the potential transport of security equipment, would have to be registered with the authority. That's going to create a lot more unnecessary work, and I don't think the board members of Transnet are going to be particularly inclined to go and do the grade A and grade B training that the Act requires them to do in order for them to be registered as security service providers. So we need to look at some of the definitions of security service and security officer. foreign ownership limitations, again, we must bear in mind that a number of large electronics companies, and I have no mandate to represent the names that I've used here, they manufacture security equipment, some locally, some imported, and to suggest that they must now be partially locally owned is going to result in disinvestment, because the likes of Philips and Siemens and some of the Japanese companies are certainly not going to make their stock locally held, locally owned. They'd rather just simply get out of the country. And I've also indicated as well that there are some security companies that are listed on the JSE or on foreign stock exchanges. There's no control over who owns those shares, because those shares are publicly traded. And they might be purchased on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, but by someone who's based in Singapore or Hong Kong. So there's no way that you can effectively control that. I then go on and deal with the area that I have the most concern about, and that is ministerial powers. I want to give an example of why ministerial powers should be circumscribed. The second party that I represent, Nicholl Stainer & Associates, as I indicated, has an Indian national as a shareholder. 4 years ago, that national applied for an exemption in terms of the Act to be excluded and exempted from the training requirements. That application is made to the Minister of Police. No decision was made until I obtained a court order nearly 4 years later compelling the Minister and the industry regulatory authority to exempt my client. If it takes 4 years for one decision, how long will it take the Minister to make decisions for what requirements a cash and transit company needs? When a foreign national or a foreign entity can be exempted from provisions of the Act? When security officers who are not citizens may be exempted? A lot of the security officers currently registered in this country are not citizens. And I want to move on to that as well, because the limitation on both ownership and participation in the industry to citizens is unconstitutional. I've had a look at the Bill of Rights, and this is not in my presentation, but if one looks at Section 7 of the Constitution, it says this Bill of Rights is a cornerstone of democracy in South Africa. It enshrines the rights of all people in our country. No distinction is made between a citizen and a resident. So I would be of the view that to say that only citizens can participate in the industry would be unconstitutional, and there is no provision made in any event, apart from an exemption, for all of those permanent residents or persons on refugee permits who are currently registered with the authority, and there are tens of thousands of those persons. I don't think the Minister's office or the authority has the capacity at present to process exemptions. I make the note that there are no guidelines in the Act specifying how to make the decision and what factors should be taken into account when it comes to providing for exemptions. I have difficulties, as I've indicated, with unfettered discretions. You need to put into the legislation how a government official should make a decision, and you need to put into the legislation a time frame when a decision should be made. And it will avoid, for example, the case I mentioned where it took the Minister nearly 4 years and he still didn't make the decision. We need to avoid that because it results in costly litigation against the state, and I would suggest embarrassment for the Minister as well. If I can also just add, and I know that there's representatives of the industry authority here, after I obtained a court order by consent, they then decided to go and rescind that judgment at taxpayers' expense, and that's currently opposed in the North Gauteng High Court. If I may, Madam Chair, there's one or two other issues which in preparing for today's presentation, I wanted to mention, which is not in my original presentation, and that is the the amendments to the Act that require that the Central Firearms Registry provide information concerning ownership of companies' firearms to CIRA, the authority. There have been some wonderful progressive steps made by the Central Firearms Registry, but one of them is not record keeping. The records of the Central Firearms Registry remain extremely problematic and inaccurate. So the requirement that the Central Firearms Registry provide information to CIRA on 30 days' notice cannot be implemented at this stage, and I would suggest that if that change is going to be made to the Private Security Industry Regulatory Act, then you need to put a time frame in the amendment bill by when that must become effective. By way of example, in 2004, when the Firearms Control Act became effective, 1st of July, there's a requirement that all dealers in firearms have electronic connectivity with the Central Firearms Registry. And that has not happened. 8 years later, it has not happened. So there's a number of challenges in the implementation of what is required of the Central Firearms Registry in legislation. So I would hesitate to put something like this into this bill unless there's a time frame prescribed by when it has to be done. Otherwise, it will not be done. In conclusion, I would like, in addition to what's up there, I've highlighted some of the constitutional issues, the fact that we must make the industry open to all, it must address past discrimination, etc. I'd like this committee to urge very serious consideration to amending the Act to allow industry representation on the Council of CIRA, because that will open up lines of communication to avoid, hopefully, the mistrust and the standoff that currently exists between the industry and the authority. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just before I open for members for questions, I would like to say, because of the comment that Mr. made, that you indicated that you see there are many of the big companies that are not making presentations. Every single organization who have made a submission have been invited to make oral submissions. So we simply did not receive submissions from them.
I understand that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So it's not a question that we're excluding them.
Not at all. And I'm not the one suggesting that.
Can you just switch off your microphone, please? Members, I'm going to allow you questions. Keep the time in mind, please. Questions of clarity. Mr. George, Honourable Ndlovu, Sibiya, Honourable Molevatsi, and Honourable Legetu.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wood. I will not discuss some of the statements, because all the things you made are statements, which I will ask to discuss.
Honourable George, can I ask you just to bring your microphone a bit closer?
I think some of the presentations were more statements made by which would need our examination. You talk about giving powers of arrest to security officers. As you are a lawyer, have you looked at the Constitution? Because look at what you're saying, you're effectively going to have two police forces in the country. Police institutions, and also the what's going to be the status of these people in court and all that. Have you looked at all those things? Just like you said,
Can we go on to your next question, please?
The other thing, like I said, the salaries of the officers are good. I don't know what you mean by that. Of course, I saw in census the average. Because the space is also a need. If you go to mine and take guys who are getting 2 million and guys are 4,000, surely the average is going to look good because of that 2 million. You see, I mean, everything that is there on average is going to weaknesses. Because when you talk average, 2 million and 4,000, surely it's going to take it to somewhere. So I don't know which security officers you're talking about, which salaries are good. This partnership, because they said it, you're also repeating it. How do you hope this partnership, again taking from your statement, that state what can be done. How do you hope this partnership between the security industry and the security industry and the police or the is going to be done?
Unknown law?
Thank you, Jefferson. I just got only two questions. Let's talk about foreign ownership. You said withdrawal of certain industries or manufacturers will make people to lose jobs. Can you elaborate on that? Have you researched it and you know exactly why you make this statement? The second question that I want to ask from Mr. Woods, the center. If you say that there will be no control of people because they are the shares are listed in the stock exchange, there's no control of people who will buy it. What do you mean? Because what I hear about the resolution of this deal is that we talk about 51%, 49%. Why are you talking about you can't control people who are buying shares and so on? Because that, to me, are you talking about funding or whatever? If that's the case, can you just elaborate on that, Mr. Wood, so that we will understand exactly where you're coming from? Thank you very much.
Other walls will be up. Thanks, Jefferson. Jefferson, mainly on the issue of unaccountable power, if you can elaborate more, if you are saying subsection 2A is extremely dangerous, do you mean that you must get rid of the whole subsection, or what must we do? Thanks. Romulobati.
Thanks, Chairperson. We are sitting here with an unborn baby. Unfortunately, the presenter is already taking up that the baby will be disabled. And that is kind of disturbing. You made mention of the lack of communication. Is the public hearing not addressing them? And if it is not, at what stage do you want consultation to take place? If you think, a second question is, if you think the 51% of the local ownership will not be well received by big companies like Samsung and yourself, what do you recommend? The other thing that you told us was, you said most of the security officers are black. What you didn't tell us is, how many of them are South African? Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Lechi.
Thanks, Chair. Let me thank the presentation. You are saying some security, private security. protective services don't need regulation. You're saying they don't need to be over-regulated. We're talking about the fiber nuts. Or who are you referring to? I find it very strange that cannot regulate the security industry. You are talking about this investment. In the country, I think the industry is profit driven. Maybe, and we see a lot of criminals joining the private security. Not like that. That is a concern to me. How do you deal with that? Thanks, sir.
Also, a couple of questions from my side. Can you elaborate for us why you say there is mistrust between the regulating authority and the industry? If you could just elaborate on that, because it's quite a serious statement to make. Also, the question was partly covered by the Honourable Molabati on the issue of consultation. You made it quite clear that it was not an open process. What do you base that on? The issue of limitation of rights, have you taken that in consideration? You say there's no difference between, you know, a citizen and a resident in terms of limitation of rights, but there are actually. For instance, permanent residents are not allowed to vote. That's one example of it. So, and it's also not expropriation, because the companies are given 5 years to sell their shares. I see you smiling. I think you mistake the questions in the way that we're asking them. We're trying to get more information so that we can take a better informed decision. That's why we have these public hearings. The comment around Philips and Siemens, I found an interesting comment, because I need some explanation on it, because clearly that is not the intention. And if you say that is the unintended consequences, then we need to look at it. We do need to regulate companies that import and distribute security equipment. But we need to differentiate between what we are saying, because if we can agree on the one, then we need to rework the other. The issue of the firearm register, take a note of that. Yeah, that's it from my side. Can you respond to those? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To go back to the first question of the Honourable Mr. George, we mustn't confuse the power of arrest and those provisions of Section 49 of the Criminal Procedure Act that allow the use of force in an arrest. Section 49 is extremely problematic, this committee knows that. What I'm suggesting, and I think what the authority and what the industry is suggesting, is that subject to the right training, you need to allow certain categories of security officers the power to search, because the security officer only has what we call civilian powers, in other words, the powers that you and I have, whereas the law enforcement official has the right under certain circumstances to conduct searches, to seize objects that may be the proceeds of crime, which may be used in the committing of a crime, and then to make arrests. What I'm suggesting is that you need to give limited powers, and they need to be defined, and I accept that they need to be defined, to allow security officers in conjunction with SAPS to operate with powers of arrest and powers to search and seize. I'm not for one moment that suggesting that security officers act as police without police supervision. I'm suggesting if you're going to have a partnership of SAPS and security companies, it will be done together, and that that the security officers with SAPS have the powers, limited as they may be, to search and seize and to make arrests. That's what I'm suggesting. It's for the legislators to decide if it's feasible, and it's for them to come up with the necessary wording of the legislation, but I do believe it can be done. You asked about salaries. I can only speak from colloquial experience in the industry, from cases that I've been involved in, that people do get paid relatively good salaries. But I can't take it any further than that, and I don't think it's really necessary to debate. You asked how to implement partnerships. Partnerships are based upon cooperation, understanding, and a mutual objective. And that ties in with what the chairperson said about the mistrust, and I'd like to expand upon that when I answer her question. Mr. Norvu asked me about withdrawal in industry participation. If you, and the chairperson is correct when he used the word expropriation, it may not be expropriation, but it's certainly a forced disposal of an asset if you are told within 5 years that asset can no longer be yours. And I do believe and I foresee that if you start dictating to industry as to who can own what and how, that will result in disinvestment and it will result in job losses. It's inevitable. So if you try to dictate how the economy works, how a free market economy works by saying certain categories of people or entities can and cannot own certain businesses, particularly when those businesses, as they exist now, are foreign-owned, you're going to have disinvestment. Mr. Beer asked me about unaccountable powers. I can't really answer that with any specificity other than to just reiterate that we need to specify in legislation exactly how something should be done so that there is certainty. And powers must be properly described, not left in broad, unspecified terms, because that gives rise to misinterpretation. One person may think a power is much greater than what another person thinks, and that's why you need to be specific. It avoids conflict, it avoids legal disputes. The lack of communication and consultation. Yes, this process is most certainly the part of the consultation. But that is not all that I mean by a lack of communication and mistrust. A regulatory body regulates, and in order to do so, it needs to give feedback to and receive feedback from what it regulates. And if I can give a parallel example, the police with the Central Firearms Registry have put in place a number of forums and roadshows where they're giving feedback to the firearm-owning public. And they're taking into account that feedback, and they're acting in a positive way on that feedback. And that's what the regulatory authority in respect of the security industry needs to do. But it isn't. It isn't actually communicating. And if I can give an example, there was a unilateral decision, I think at the beginning of this year, I was not involved in this, where the subscription fees were massively increased by CIRA. And they were interdicted by the High Court from implementing that because there was no consultation with the industry. And that's what I'm talking about. When you regulate, you must consult as well. You don't have to agree, but you have to explain yourself. We live in a democracy. Any decision by any regulatory body is subject to explanation. And that's why, Madam Chair, if the industry, for example, has representation on the council, then the industry cannot say there's no communication, because it's the responsibility of that representative to provide communication back to the industry. And there are industry bodies. I see that the Security Industry Alliance and SAHITSA are going to make presentations. And if you ask them, they will tell you that there is no feedback and no proper communication between them and the regulatory authority. And it has to be urgently addressed. You have to get the buy-in of the industry that you regulate. You have to get their participation. I was asked a question about regulation and fly-by-nights.
certain parts of the informal sector that do not need to be regulated by this legislation. And I use the example of car guards, who we all know exist in the various shopping centres that we may go to. I don't believe that they need to be regulated. I don't think that they need to be trained and they need to be formalised, because those people cannot afford the training. And I don't see the relevance of training to a person that stands next to a car to provide some form of informal guarding service. And if you insist that they become regulated, then it's going to be a bar to entry to the industry. When it comes to regulating fly-by-nights, that is the requirement of the regulatory authority. And that is already provided for in the legislation. Yes, it could be made better. And I would suggest that it needs to be made better. But that is the responsibility of the regulatory authority. And if I can just add, I spoke about the capacity of the authority. I've attended numerous disciplinary inquiries at the regulatory authority. And the level of skill of prosecutors needs to be seriously looked at if you want to regulate this industry properly. The Act provides that the authority can fine and in certain instances deregister participants in the industry. But you need to be able to convict them to do that. And unfortunately, the prosecutorial services in the industry regulatory authority are very, very lacking in skills and expertise in that regard. The comment was made that the many criminals in the industry. You can become a security officer with a criminal conviction, and in fact the bill provides that after 10 years certain categories of convictions become irrelevant. I personally do not have a difficulty with that. If a person has rehabilitated himself and if they have served their debt to society, they should not be prevented from earning a living. Every person that becomes registered with the authority is supposed to go through a criminal record check, and the provisions relating to who can or cannot be registered with the authority are clear in the Act, so I don't think that that's a problem. The problem area may be, and this was raised by one of the honourable members, that foreign nationals may be participating in the industry and they may have criminal backgrounds. I accept that's a possibility. My answer to that is that I believe that, for example, people on refugee permits can be registered with the authority, and it's difficult in those circumstances to obtain a foreign police clearance for that individual. Bearing that in mind, I would suggest that the answer is that if the foreign national wants to become part of the industry, they must provide a local and a foreign police clearance to confirm that they have no criminal convictions. So I don't think that that is a particularly large problem at all. The Honourable Chairperson wanted me to just discuss expropriation versus forced disposal. I concede it's not expropriation, but the forced disposal of some form of asset is still not good for the economy. And you can sugarcoat it as much as you want, but if you tell a company that they have to dispose of 51% of their shares within a time period, that's not a free market economy, because it creates an ideal environment for buyers who can force the price down, and it forces the value of the business down, because the seller knows that they have to do something within a fixed time period. And many organizations may choose to stop participating in the economy as a result of that. They may be unhappy with having local ownership. They may have corporate policies that dictate against foreign ownership, against local ownership. You specifically mentioned Phillips and Siemens. I don't have a mandate from Phillips and Siemens. I've just used their names because they're international corporates that trade in many, many different countries, and they have factories here, for example. You said that Madam Chair said we need to regulate the import and distribution of security equipment. Yes, I would concede that, but I would also suggest, and this is not an issue I've had time to consider, But I would also suggest that one may need to look at the National Convention on Arms Control legislation, because many items of security equipment would definitely fall under that legislation. So we have an overlapping here of a potential overlapping of legislation. I will certainly go back and consider it and make some additional comments if I'm allowed to. But I do concede that one has to regulate the import of that type of equipment, but I don't think that is the concern that I've expressed. As the chair, please.
by using a key cutter front to bypass registration, could operate with unregistered, poorly trained staff with no growth or career opportunities, and would not be subject to any serial inspectorate. Modern key duplicating machines differ vastly from those of the past. Modern key duplicating machines are computer software driven, linked or standalone machines with powerful software pre-installed. These duplicating machines does not require a key as a sample anymore. All a key cutter needs is your vehicle identification number, or commonly known as a VIN number, from your license disc. With this information, your vehicle mechanical and transponder key code can be obtained. And for your vehicle, with a sophisticated key and transponder system, a duplicate can be made by the key cutter. These key cutting machines with powerful memory capacity can keep records of all such information. Your front gate security lock can now be duplicated with a duplicating machine by purely inserting your key number. A record thereof can be kept or deleted at discretion of the key cutter. I quote from an article that appeared in the Landbridge Sun of April 2005, and I quote.
Sorry, can I just interrupt you? I saw a photograph taken. You're not allowed to take photographs in meetings without asking for permission to do so, please. It's also disrupting the members.
Thank you. I quote, holding the key to your safety. Keep keys separate and never let your house keys out of your hand. This is the warning from a leader who, without thinking, handed her bunch of containing both car and house keys to a representative from a well-known car tire company when he repaired a flat tire for her. What she did not know was that some of these places also have machines that can copy keys. One of the servicemen copied her house keys because she had dealt with a company before and had all her particulars on file. 2 days later, the man entered her home with ease and attacked her. Months later, the bandit was caught and his modus operandi was uncovered. Unquote. The concern of the Locksmiths Association is that these key cutters are currently excluded from the proposed amendments, leaving a sector with powerful equipment who has access to the majority of the consumer security and the integrity thereof unregistered and unaccountable. The Locksmith Association is of the opinion that a key is critical to every individual security and the duplication thereof should be regulated in line with what the draft bill envisages, as per subsection B, promote crime prevention. The proposed definition of a locksmith in its current form only focuses on a small section of our industry, still working on outdated vaults, safes and deposit boxes. The vast majority of locksmiths who has moved on to the modern equipment with diagnostic machines, duplicating machines and laptops, calling themselves key specialists or fitment centres, anything but a locksmith, have the luxury of being excluded and exempted from the Act. The following proposed admission for the definition of a locksmith is inadequate. Locksmith means a person for the benefit of another person engages in any activity or business related to the designing and managing master key systems. Most of these master key systems are designed and managed by the manufacturers, and the relevance thereof applicable to a locksmith limited. B. Installing, maintaining, repairing and changing the combination of safes, vaults and safety deposit boxes. Relevant to only a small sector of the industry, markets are moving into remote activation of locking mechanisms via GSM modules and time delays. C. Maintain key code records, not limited to a locksmith but applicable to manufacturers and every individual who has access to a key duplicating machine who is currently excluded from the Act. D. Cutting keys otherwise than by duplicating existing keys. With modern equipment, the same key duplicating machine is used for cutting, duplicating, introducing keys. This function is not limited to a locksmith, but applicable to every individual who has access to a key duplicating machine, and these functions are intertwined. E, opening, closing, or engaging of a locking mechanism for, of any nature by means of a specialized device in any manner. This is relevant, but a specialized device needs to be better defined. The Locksmith Association requests that the proposed definition of a locksmith be amended to include all disciplines within our industry and propose the following definition of a locksmith. This definition is the outcome of a consultative workshop with private security and industry representatives chaired by CEDAR on the 26th and the 27th of October 2010. A locksmith means a person who, for the benefit of another person, engages in the activity or business which is related to the opening, closing or engaging of locking mechanisms of any nature by means of lock picking or other tools or specialized devices, or who duplicates or copy keys from a sample, or originate keys, access cards, discs, tags or other objects which are used to unlock, close, release or engage locking mechanisms by means of tools including electronic devices, key cutting machines, files or other equipment, or any other specialized device designed for the purpose of originating electronically, enabling or copying keys, access cards, discs, tags, but does not include the manufacture of keys in bulk by or for lock manufacturers. The Locksmith Association, together with SACWA, SACITA and CIRA, ensured that the necessary unit standards were registered and meet the requirements to enable all locksmith disciplines to register, including the key cutting discipline. These skills programs were published in the Government Gazette of October 2009 as draft regulations for the training of a private security service provider. The industry is eagerly awaiting the outcome of proposed amendments. Those currently registered are extremely unhappy and maintain that they are unfairly discriminated against. They have patiently waited 11 years for these amendments. Anything short of an all amended, including key cut, or anything short of an amendment, including key cutters, will be met with absolute disapproval. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, I'm going to allow questions. I would like to start off, if I may. You say you had a meeting that CILA was facilitating on in October of 2010. You must make notes of the questions, please. You will respond at the end. Yet the definition in the amendment bill does not reflect the definition that you have agreed upon on that occasion, if I understand you correctly. So I would like to just get an understanding. I think there's valid points that are raised. If we are having loopholes within the bill in terms of the definition, we need to look at that. My question, though, is you refer in your presentation specifically to the problems that you have around the registration requirements for locksmiths specifically before they can become locksmiths. You didn't mention it now, but before they can actually work, you used the argument that it's a trade and that it takes 3 to 5 years for people to learn this trade and for them to be required to do certain qualifications and courses before they can be registered and do this is unpractical. Won't you just elaborate for us on that issue, because I think it's an important issue that we need to take in consideration.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The draft amendments in 2010 was when we started in consultation. We always maintained that you can't divorce the two separate entities. It is an entity on its own, and we then envisaged that the amendments will include the key cutters at the time, and we then on the draft bill for registration and for training purposes have already made provision. So although it's not it's still in draft form, the groundwork has been done. So there would be no nothing stopping anybody from registering. The second question is that when we start off in our industry, in our trade, we have a clear career path set out with the unit standards. This career path is all the unit standards has been registered with SACWA, and also for registration purposes, we've taken some of the unit standards and we've or use them as skills programs. So the starting off for this skills program, the initiation for somebody into the industry will be key cutting. From there, they can then progress into other disciplines, whether it would be safe work, motor vehicle work, or electronic work, or any other one of the other disciplines. And some of the candidates will actually stay into the key cutting and then make that their career. We've gone the unit standards way, that for somebody to become a locksmith takes them, as you quite rightly say, can take them 3 to 5 years. It's definitely very difficult to train somebody for 3 to 5 years and not use them in any manner or let them be active. And that's why we found in the past that the candidates were not completing the courses, and the requirement was that you had to do the complete unit standard before you could then be registered. That's why we've gone the way of the skill requirements, and we've introduced the key cutter unit standards that will be accepted as a minimum required with the authorities for registration, and that will be it's very basic, and it's only a few unit standards, and once they've completed this, they will then progress further on into their career.
I want to understand clearly, because my second question was similar to the Honourable Dorvis. I want to understand clearly, because from your presentation that you sent to us, it seems like the registration at a point was a problem. Is it now resolved? Are you saying you went the route of SAQWA and therefore you feel that the issue is resolved?
Yes, we believe that the issue is in the process of being resolved. That's why we have registered a minimum qualification with a minimum amount of unit standards.
Thank you very much. It's important for us to realise that, because if it isn't, then we need to address it. Thank you very much. Members, any other further questions on this one? Thank you very much for your presentation, and thanks for the trouble of coming here. We appreciate that. We will take specifically the definition in consideration as well. Our next presentation is the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum. Sean, there is a laptop now available for your presentation, so if you want to come move here, you're welcome to do so, or send somebody here, you're welcome to do so. And hand over to you.
Madam Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you to the committee for the opportunity to comment on the CERA draft bill. I think the PowerPoint slides, and there are very few of them, are handed out, so I will just speak to those, and I won't put anything up on the projector. The African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum is a network of state and civil society practitioners formed from across the continent, working on issues of police reform and civilian oversight. And our objectives are to create and sustain public confidence in the police, to develop a culture of human rights and integrity, transparency and accountability within police, and to promote good working relationships between the police and the community. Now, while our focus has been traditionally on the subject of the public police, we're also cognizant of the fact that there have been significant developments in the policing environment, and and that it's not always easy to distinguish within a policing context between the roles of the state police and private security. The submission that we've made to the committee draws directly from a paper that we published last year entitled Regulating Private Security in South Africa, Contexts, Challenges and Recommendations. And copies of this paper are available on our website, but I've also brought additional copies for members of the committee, and I have two other copies here if anybody else would require any. Our submission focuses specifically on the issue of the oversight and accountability of the actions of individual security industry employees in cases of misconduct, and particularly the more serious cases relating to inappropriate use of firearms, use of force, death as a result of the actions of a private security guard, corruption, etc. We believe that, and is also as being provided for in the draft bill, that there's increasing blurring between private and public police, but also between private and public spaces, and that it, in this environment where we have private public spaces, such as, for example, shopping malls, the waterfront, where there's considerable reliance on private security in a space that is frequented by the general public, that role that the private security industry plays should increasingly come under the same levels of scrutiny that we expect from the state police. We believe that while the state police in South Africa, and we include the Metropolitan Police Services, are subject to extensive levels of oversight, and that there is considerable legal protection for the public against abuses by the SAPS and the MPS, there's little comparable protection in relation to the private security industry. And this is seen in two areas that we'd like to bring to the attention of the committee. First of all, there are very few centralized channels through which members of the public can lay complaints against actions of security personnel. And secondly, there is no consistent and thorough information on the nature of abuses that might be undertaken or might be performed by private security personnel, except where these come to the courts, and that requires then a review of the cases that are going through to the courts. When we look at the current regulatory environment, we see that the CERO focuses almost exclusively on the regulation of employers, the registration of employees, the enforcement of minimum working conditions, and ensuring that training standards are met. There's little oversight over the conduct of the individual security officers and officials. And under this current dispensation, incidents of individual misconduct are dependent on individual charges being laid and these investigated by the police and being brought to court. When we do look at conduct of individual employees, then we turn to the CERO Code of Conduct, and that sets out a set of binding rules for all private security employers and employees. And included in this are issues around use of force and behavior. But when we look at the sanctions that CERO can impose, and as mentioned in earlier presentations, we look at warnings, reprimands, suspensions, withdrawal of registration, fines, and publishing of details. When it comes to those more serious instances of misconduct, this is then reliance on other processes to take place. In addition, the CERO investigative capacity is also limited. In research done in 2007 by UNISA, it was found that there's limited capacity within CERO at that time, and it continues to today. And it's focused mainly on checking the registration of employees and that companies are fulfilling labour obligations. There's poor collection of evidence, resulting in little or no information going through to SAPS to build cases around prosecution. And that investigations are mostly complaints driven, coming predominantly from the public and are focused primarily around labour issues, working conditions or low wages. So we believe that this situation needs to be rectified, and we have a number of recommendations regarding this. In the first instance, we believe that a positive duty must be placed on the private security industry via CERA to submit itself to scrutiny and reporting in relation to its record of actions in relation to safeguarding human rights of South Africans or persons living in South Africa. The private security industry must be legally obliged to submit all cases of death as a result of a private security guard action, rape or torture, to an independent external facility. We believe that this facility be one of the current institutions that carry out an oversight mandate, for example, the Secretariat of Police or the IPID. Investigations, whether undertaken by SAPS or internally, should be subject to an audit and further investigation and or further investigation by an external oversight agency such as the IPID. The private security industry should be required to provide detailed public reports on its investigations and other oversight activities in relation to actions by individual employees when it comes to these cases of abuse. And reporting and analysis mechanisms that would allow for institutions like the Civilian Secretariat of Police to assess, report, and make relevant policy recommendations on any systemic issues within the industry or parts of the industry which give rights to abuse or hamper effective accountability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tate, for the presentation. Members, you've heard the presentation. Can I take any questions from the side of the members? No questions. Mr. Ndlovu?
I don't have a page. The chairperson through you. But it reads, this paragraph reads, I want you to elaborate, my brother, on no consistent and thorough information on the nature of private security company abuses, except through a review of incidents that make it to the court. Can you just elaborate? That's the first question. The second question is, under the current dispensation, instances of individual misconduct are dependent on individual charges being laid, investigated by the police and brought to court. Can you elaborate more on that? Because I wanted to understand what you're trying to say on these two issues. Thanks.
Yeah, I've also got a question if there's no other member that's raising hand. Doesn't seem like it. I would like to have an understanding. Are you saying that within the current CERA regulating Act, the current one, I'm not even talking about the amendment, but you feel that there is not enough revision made for oversight over the individual security officer. However, you do also recognize that this is a regulating act. It is not an act that should involve CERA in operational issues of any nature. Unlike IPID or even the Secretariat of Police, CERA is a regulating body. Is it a question that the Act in its current form is not making sufficient provision? I just want to get your understanding from you. Or is it a question of the provisions that are there in terms of private security officers have not been fully implemented, focused on, etc. I just need to get an understanding of what it is that you're saying.
Chairperson, there is a paragraph which says investigation were mostly complaints driven, came
consider to go into those categories? In the low wages, labor complaints, and so on and so forth. You won't see us do that. In contrast, what Mr. Wood has said.
Mr. Said, you're welcome to answer.
Thank you very much. I think the situation that we faced with is that there's increasing utilization of private security in functions that have been traditionally the terrain of the public police, and that includes protection, crime prevention activities, and response duties, and this has been expanded in the way in which public-private space has developed, so that you have mass public spaces now which are policed by private security in terms of guards in front of shopping malls, providing a service that you would have traditionally associated with the state police years ago. You also have the increasing kind of prevalence of partnership between private security and police, be these in city improvement districts, municipal improvement districts, or other forms of partnership. Now, in this environment, you have an elaborate oversight architecture available for the state police, where instances of abuse are recorded and investigated. So the South African Police Service are legally obliged to report on any death as a result of police action through to the IPED. And we can look back over the course of the year and say we've had 300 incidents and we've investigated those and we've dealt with those that amount to misconduct, and where the action is justified, we've responded appropriately. We don't have anything comparable with regard to the private security industry. And we have tens of thousands of security personnel operating on a day-to-day basis in these policing environments, most of them armed, and whether it's only one or two or five or ten incidents that occur, I think it's important for the country to be able to know what the situation is and how that is being addressed. And so when I speak to the fact that there's no consistent information on these potential abuses, then it's that I'm referring to. We simply don't know what the situation is. We don't know if firearms are being used inappropriately. We don't know if people are dying as a result of actions where security guards are involved. We don't know if there's any other serious misconduct that is being taken by security guards. In relation to the second question posed by the Honourable Ntovu, where this information is available, it's reliant on individuals laying a charge. So if somebody feels that they have been abused by the action of a private security guard or official, they would then lay a complaint at SAPS, and they would then take that hopefully through the normal criminal justice process. The only way that we'd be able to get access is if we go through court cases and court reviews to get an understanding of just what the level of compliance and respect for human rights are within the private security industry. Now, often these remedies are not available to more marginalized and disenfranchised communities or members, particularly when it comes to vagrants and the interaction between some of the guarding duties and vagrants on the street. I think that this is a gap within the current regulatory framework within the private security industry. We've seen over the period of the South African democracy a growing regulation of private security. In the first instance, there was this move to professionalize the industry. During the second phase of regulation, we saw increasing emphasis being placed on the labor environment and working conditions. And I think as we enter this new opportunity of re-looking at CIRA and the bill that's on the table, these oversight and accountability issues should be brought into sharper focus. And in some instances, we are doing that. So we're looking at questions of ownership. We're looking at the role of CERO. We're looking at how we can strengthen that regulatory environment. But the omission is the actions of private security personnel, and it's a question of how we bring that in. The CERO itself and the role that it plays, if it's based on the current capacity levels and skill levels, then as the point was made in earlier presentations, I don't think there is the capacity and the resources to be able to do that. And we need to look at the other agencies available. Thank you.
Can I just ask Sira for clarity on this issue? How many, if you can give us an indication, on the number of private security officers that you've deregistered or withdrawn the registration in the past financial year?
Madam Chair, can we just get the information for you?
It is 10:45. Tea is ready. We're going to break for 15 minutes. We'll be back at 11 o'clock. We've got one more presentation for the day.
Thank you. Thank you.
question in terms of the private security offices that have been deregistered for, if you can also give us an indication for reasons that you've deregistered them. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've deregistered 160 of the security officers, individuals. The reasons we deregister most of these security officers is that we have the code of conduct of security officers. The code of conduct has got the rules in which they have to abide by, and we then prosecute them for contravening the code of conduct. And it could be for anything, including being involved in murder, robbery, rapes, and everything. However, we do that on the basis when there is complaints that have been reported to us, and there is a general obligation on the employers to also report these cases to us. And when they are reported, we then deal with them. Some of them we proactively pick them up from the media, from the newspapers, when we see security officers are involved. Even if the case is still running in the courts, we do get in and investigate, and we deal with those issues as we see them. So the code of conduct is quite very broad, and more specific on the conduct of security officers. I think from that point, it is much more comprehensive.
I am going to request that you make available tomorrow enough copies for members specifically around two issues. The one is the code of conduct regarding security officers, and second thing is if you can also make available as the regulations regarding locksmiths, just that section of it, so that we can have a look at that as well, the regulations, because that would address some of the problems that have been raised by locksmiths. Specifically around the registration process, so that we can just have a look at it when we start discussing it, if you don't mind doing that first. Our next presenters are SALUS Protection Services. Are they here? Services Association? Not here either. Okay, so presenters 4 and 5 are not here. Can I ask members that we do have the submissions available, that have been invited. We do have the submissions available. It means that we have an early day, that members go through these submissions, please, so that we can take the issues that are raised in consideration. There is also a summary available to members that was done by the state law advisors on the submissions and what it speaks to on the different clauses. So, and also one from the researchers, yes. So if we can also look at that. Nadia, we might want to ask the researchers also just next week to quickly run through those presentations Tuesday when we do meet around those issues, please. Minister, that means we have an early meeting today. And we will be back. Yeah.
Chairperson, let us be clear. South African intruders directly, they were not told at the time. They were.
No. They have indicated that they won't be coming.
Oh, okay.
They've indicated that we thought Saul is going to be here. So they've indicated they're not coming. So we would have finished early in any case today, so we just finishing a bit earlier. So we will be back tomorrow in Good Hope Chambers at 1:30, members. 1:30, Good Hope Chambers. We've got permission to sit here in the sitting. Thank you very much.
Hello. Thank you. Yeah.